Neve Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neve's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. I'm Lydia L. Khoury.
And I'm Shirley Heyman.
And this evening we've got a fantastic array of guests and we're very excited on The Parents Show about it. We're going to be talking about how schools and if schools are preparing our children for life's ups and downs. And we're extremely pleased to be talking to Professor Guy Claxton, who is Emeritus Professor of Learning Sciences at the Centre for Real World Learning in the University of Winchester. Now, Professor Claxton, for those of you who don't know, and I'd say there aren't that many, is a revered and highly respected cognitive scientist, and he's well known for his work on learning power. But tonight we're speaking to him about an upcoming book he's writing for parents on how schools are preparing children for life.
And as we're talking about schools, we thought it would be a great opportunity to hear from some of our local schools. So in the studio tonight we've got Morag, help me Lydia,
McCrory,
thank you, deputy head teacher of Beaumont School, and Amanda Godfrey, who is the executive head of Spirals Academies.
Oh, it should be Academic Trust.
Academic Trust.
Sorry.
And we're sure we'll find out more about Amanda's role later.
But without further ado, we'd like to get straight on to chatting to Professor Guy Claxton. Guy, thank you so much for joining us on The Parents Show.
Not at all. It's a pleasure.
We're very excited about having you on the show because we know you've got a huge background in learning, but we're going to take you off your usual discussion about learning power this evening.
Guy, I mean, from what we've been reading and, you know, sort of genning up on you a bit, we were thinking that you're saying unless we understand the future for which we're preparing our children, we actually do tragic damage to them when we teach them. You know, can you expand on that a little bit for our listeners?
Well, tragic damage is putting it a bit dramatically.
Okay.
There are a lot of children who find a good school, who like their teachers, who are supported well, who are happy and who have a good time. But in the research for the new book that you mentioned, we've discovered that there are an awful lot of families and an awful lot of children who aren't having that good time, and it's a whole constellation of factors. It may be just a personality clash with a teacher, but we think there's something a bit deeper than that, something a bit more structural about schools. It's not to do with whether teachers themselves are caring or doing a good job. Almost all of them absolutely are. But the question is whether we really need to take a long, hard look at actually what kind of future we're preparing young people for. And I don't just mean those who are going to go to university, but, you know, all the people who are going to be plumbers and hairdressers mm-hmm. and cooks and animators and whatever it might be, and say, are we really doing everything we can to help them get ready to meet the stresses and challenges and opportunities of a particularly demanding time in our history, I think. So that's the starting point for the book.
Okay, and you know, can you just sort of very briefly talk to us about where you think the emphasis in, you know, the learning needs to be to help our young people?
Well, obviously, we need to be concerned about literacy and numeracy. We need young people, I mean, it's basic strategy, which everybody knows, that we need to help young people learn to read and write and
yes.
calculate up to a certain point. The question is, what happens after that? And I think we've got a bit obsessed with driving people towards university entrance, with testing and measuring young people, and maybe not always, maybe in that process, we've squeezed out some of the more personal qualities, which all the research shows young people are going to need in the future. And we've become a bit too much addicted, I think, to our tests and our exams and judging schools on their Key Stage 2 SATs results and their GCSEs. And there's an extra layer. It's not in contradiction to tests and knowledge and literacy, but there's another layer which is as important, if not more important, with sometimes gets a bit forgotten or a bit squeezed out. And our book is trying to connect parents with what those other qualities which young people are going to need, with what they might be.
Could you give us a flavour of what kind of qualities you're talking about?
For sure. Well, one of the most popular ones that gets talked about a lot these days is resilience or grit.
Mm.
Grit means the inclination to stick with things that you're passionate about and to stick with them despite short-term distractions, to remember your long-term goals, if you like. We know that that's one of the most powerful predictors of people's success or satisfaction with their lives. So designing schools that give people the opportunity to build that quality of stickability, or I call it sometimes craftsmanship, that pleasure in taking time to produce something that is really satisfying, something that you're proud of, is something that all of us, I think, ought to have, whether we're a mum or a carpenter or a cartoonist or a neurosurgeon. It doesn't matter. That idea that, you know, we put in the time and the effort to produce the best thing we can. Unfortunately, a lot of schools are so chopped up into 55 minutes of this and 55 minutes of that, that often youngsters don't have that opportunity to really get their teeth into something. Well, they do when they're small, but as they go up through school, things get more and more sort of homogenized and chopped up and pre-digested and pre-packaged so that everything has to fit into an hour. And that takes a lot of the exciting, it takes a lot of the juggliness out of learning, which you need to learn to deal with if you're going to thrive in the big wide world out there.
So are you instigating that there should be actual times within the day of the secondary school where they get to just work on, you know, being more resilient, playing, reasoning, collaborating? Or are you saying that that should be a method, a strategy that the teachers use in every subject?
I don't think it's either or. I think we're a bit bedeviled in education with either ors. I tend to be a bit of a both and kind of chap. So I think, yes, plenty of well-designed, well-structured project work. Sometimes people give project work a bad name, but that's only because it's done badly. Anything done badly gets a bad name. But project work done well gives youngsters an opportunity to learn those skills of planning, organizing, collaborating, reflecting, self-evaluating, coping with frustration, and coming out at the end of the process with something that you're very happy with. So there are lots of schools. I mean, the future, someone famous, I forget his name, once said, the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed at the moment. And there are lots and lots of schools that are doing these kinds of, that are making changes to give youngsters more of a really challenging, enjoyable, stretching kind of process. Not something that demoralizes them, but something that energizes them and fires them up. But not all schools are. And some schools, I think, just need a bit of help and a bit of encouragement to move in those directions, to believe that they can keep on getting the results, which they need to do. Obviously, for Ofsted and parents want their kids to do well, to get the best results they possibly can, but to do it in a way that also builds these other transferable qualities. And that weaves through lessons, and it also has implications for how you structure the timetable. There's a school I was in the other day that every so often has a three-day, this is a secondary school, a three-day lesson in design technology, in which all the year nines can really, you know, get their teeth into a meaty challenge over 3 days without being constantly interrupted by the damn bell and made to kind of pack up and go off and do something else. Now, that doesn't sound particularly revolutionary to me. It just sounds like common sense, because the world is like that.
Yeah.
The world is not chopped up into neat little hours of everything. So let's make school a little bit more like the real world so that youngsters can get better for it, can get prepared for it better.
And Guy, that sounds fantastic. And imagining, you know, a bunch of young children sitting down for 3 days working on one subject is fantastic. How much does technology hinder that kind of process?
Technology, I mean, technology is like anything else. It can be, it all depends on how you use it, doesn't it? You know, you can use it for good or you can use it for ill. I remember a school I was in a little while ago, and in next door classrooms, they were both using technology, but in one classroom, they were using technology just like a textbook on a screen. They were doing same old, working through math problems. It's just instead of the coming, instead of being on a book, they were on a screen. And in the next door classroom, they were designing websites and creating their own problems and learning how to code and do all kinds of other interesting things. So the technology can be used in all kinds of different ways. One of the most interesting researchers around in education at the moment is a man called Sugata Mitra, who's Indian, has a post in Delhi, but also works at one of the universities in the UK. He's done a lot of work on children working with technology. And he's discovered some very simple sort of guidelines, if you like. They're not rules. Get four or five children round a single machine. Don't have too many machines, where they have to argue, collaborate, discuss. Give them a really interesting question, and let them run for 45 minutes and see what they can come up with. And he's discovered that often groups of children, even quite young children, can astonish their teachers and even sometimes their parents with the amount of, with their ability to self-organize their learning, to explore, discover, discuss, ask questions, find the right website, and come back after 45 minutes with an astonishing amount of information about a simple, intriguing question like, why do we have five fingers and toes? Why not four or six or eight? Why five? Just give them a question and let them run. And often it turns out with the use of technology that less is more, you know. If you just give the kids an interesting question and let them run, they'll be excited about it, and in the process of arguing and exploring and inquiring, they're stretching exactly those, what I call, learning muscles, which they're going to need in order to flourish out there in the big wide world.
You know, hearing you speak like that, Guy, it reminds us of another guest we had. I don't know if you've heard of him, called Peter Worley, who really promotes children doing philosophy thing, that kind of thing.
And I don't know him in particular, but I know there's a movement in many schools called Philosophy for Children, which is absolutely that same kind of track that I'm talking about. And sometimes, even in the year 2015, there are children sitting in rows silently working their way through problems on learning how to add fractions.
Yeah.
And nobody adds fractions these days. And nor is there any evidence that struggling to learn how to add fractions makes you any better at anything else.
Why
bother? Why not do something more engaging and more gripping? But there is a lobby out there who say, no, it's like, you know, somebody came down from the mountain with tablets of stone which said, thou shalt study the Tudors and fractions.
It's a rite of passage.
Sort of stuck with it. And some people think that if we're not doing that, we've gone all sort of floppy and liberal and we're not being serious or disciplined about what young people need to learn, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Now you're probably aware that this is a parent show, so lots of our listeners are parents. I'm just wondering if you could say some helpful things about how parents can support these kind of dispositions towards learning.
Well, I think from the research that we've done for the book, I think the first and most important thing is for parents and their children, if they are struggling with school, to see this not as a failing on the part of the child or the family, but actually as the children very often, not always, but very often sort of responding to the kinds of issues that we've just been talking about. So we've had some lovely stories of children who are happy at school, but one, excuse me, I've got the winter cough and cold.
Poor you.
I may splutter occasionally, if you'll forgive me.
Of course.
Just looking at at one of the quotes from a parent, from a London mum, talking about her daughter at primary school, and she says, if I can just quote this to you, "My daughter was like some spirally little shape that was being pushed into a square box, and it was soul-destroying.
Mm.
I'd take this gorgeous little girl to school, and then I'd pick up this really deflated person. She's quite creative and dreamy. She'd look out of the window, see a cloud, and make up a story, but the teachers would shout at her to focus on her work. She became more insecure, more deflated. She cried more. She'd always been a good sleeper, but she started waking up at night. She gets so overtired by the workload that she kind of zones out. So she's not having much happy awake time. And that's no way to live."
No.
Now, I think there are dozens, if not hundreds, of parents listening to this program who, unfortunately, will resonate with that sentiment, who worry that their child is becoming stressed or anxious or sometimes even brutalized by their experience of being at school, who lose their soft edges and their loving ways of being with other people and toughen up in a way that parents don't like. So I don't think it does any, you know, this is absolutely not about attacking teachers, but it is about saying, let's be realistic about the fact that school works well for some children and doesn't work well for many others. And that doesn't mean that those other children are naughty or lazy or unmotivated or babyish. They have a right to their reactions to school, and parents should feel confident that it's not something wrong with the child. There may be something wrong with the system that the child is being squeezed through. That's, I think, for me, what we discovered was the first and most important thing. But it's like, you know, parents and families can heave a sigh of relief and say, oh, it's not just us, you mean. And that part of the function of our book is to try and help parents feel more powerful in a way, or give parents more confidence or more of a voice if their children are struggling with school, that they can have a grown-up conversation with the school and try and help the school to develop in ways that might be more appropriate, not just to that child, but to the demands of the real world.
Do you think that parents, even in small numbers, can have an impact on schools? Because I just seem so overwhelming. I mean, schools are under so much pressure from Ofsted, from other parents to, you know, mill through the material, stick to the curriculum. It feels like a Herculean task.
Yes, it does. And the more you're on the more you're on your own, the more it feels that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So part of what this book is about is to try, and we're going to try and create a website and give some opportunity for parents to talk to other parents. I'm sure lots of people on Mumsnet and NetMum and all of those organizations do this already. But in a particular locality, perhaps to give parents some greater sense of solidarity and courage and confidence so that they can talk to schools, particularly parents themselves who might have had not completely happy or satisfactory experiences of school. They can feel rather intimidated. And I think it would be helpful if we could give to parents a way, maybe some clearer ways of articulating, it's not just there's something wrong with my son or my daughter, but there are really important cultural issues, social issues, political issues here that we, the parents and the school, could get together and address. And as I say, there are lots of schools that work well with parents that are doing this already, but there are still, I think, some schools out there who, with the best will in the world, are a bit daunting or sometimes even a bit defensive in their relationships with parents. And we have to get over that, because we all want the best for the children, don't we?
Absolutely.
And we need to work together to make sure that that happens.
Absolutely. And I mean, I know you know this, but I mean, our experience of teachers on the Parents' Show has always been astonishing for me, for somebody, you know, who went to school and had none of the support that children have nowadays. I mean, teachers nowadays are thinking about all the avenues that
you're
absolutely
very often are thinking about all the avenues that you're talking about.
Yeah, indeed.
But they themselves have their hands tied. Even if parents want it and teachers want it, is it possible to change the system to a significant extent?
excuse me. yes, but you have to do it gradually and you have to be patient. It's not going to, it's like that old thing about how do you eat an elephant, one bite at a time. And, you know, the first step is for parents and schools to be working together, to start a conversation. I remember working with a primary school in Milton Keynes, on the outskirts of Milton Keynes. They made huge strides in changing the culture and the practices of the school. But the way they did it was for the head teacher of the school to engage the community. And it wasn't a sort of, you know, fortunate middle-class community by any manner of means, but to do her best to engage that community around the question, what do we really want for our kids? And she spent 12 or 15 months building that conversation. What kinds of people do we want our children to be? What kinds of people do we think they're going to need to be? What kind of strengths are they going to need to have if they're going to flourish in a world which is fast-changing, demanding, stressful, exciting, all of those things? And then once you've started to do that, once you've got below the conversation about SATs and Ofsted and grades and levels and targets, and brought your parents and the teachers, and in many cases the children themselves, together around that deeper question, not of what I sometimes call not just about schooling, but truly about education, then you can get a mandate to move forward much quicker. And in our experience, almost all parents, once you get to that deeper level, almost all parents will engage with schools. If they feel welcome into that conversation, then you've got a platform when you can do all kinds of really interesting things on top of that.
Thank you. Guy, another thing that parents are very concerned about is if they're told their child has low self-esteem. And the reaction often is to say, well, we need to praise them more. But I think that's something you say, use with care, don't you, praise, you know?
Yes, there's a lot of, it's a very understandable impulse. Mm. If your child is, like the quotation that I read out a few minutes ago, if your child is deflated, then it's a human impulse to try and plump them up. And tell them how, you know, that they're fine really, and they're really smart, and, you know, that's a lovely picture, sweetheart, and to do whatever we can to try and sort of plump them up again. And that's not all. The research shows, research by a wonderful woman in America called Carol Dweck, who's become quite famous for this research, shows that there is, well-intentioned though that is, there's a risk, there's a serious risk buried in that, which is if you praise your child for their ability, if you tell them how smart they are or how good they are or how what a wonderful artist they are or how lovely that what a great writer they are, the risk is that they become sort of addicted to that idea, the children, and therefore they become more anxious about not living up to that ideal. They've been told that they're clever or that they're gifted and talented, so they've got to be.
Yeah.
And that's a real, that's not just a bit of psychologist mumbo jumbo, that's a really live risk for children in school. If children feel that they've got to live up to some standard, then often they become really much more anxious about making mistakes or failing or even just being adventurous, even just having a go at something that they don't know that they can already look good at. And there are even three and four-year-olds who somewhere or other have picked up the idea that to be a good little girl means to be a correct little girl, a bright little girl, a sort of performing seal of a little girl.
Yeah.
And they can become, even when they arrive in reception class, they can be terribly anxious about, they won't try anything unless they've been reassured five times that it's going to be all right and they should just have a go. And that's very damaging to their not only to their pleasure in life, their joy in life, but also to their learning, isn't it? It's like, you know, learning requires effort, it requires experimentation, it requires asking when you don't understand or asking for help. But if somehow or other you've got the idea that you're ashamed of yourself if you don't know everything already, or if you have to ask for help, or you don't understand what you're supposed to be doing, then that can lock you in, and that in itself can become a source of this anxiety and deflation. So we need to be careful. The sort of the standard bit of advice is, you know, by all means praise the action, but yes, don't praise the person.
Okay, that's really
helpful.
That's
a great picture.
Yeah.
Tell me how you did it.
Yeah.
Now, if you have another look at it, how do you think you could make it even better? Have a conversation about the process of making, rather than only about was it good or was it bad.
Mm.
Well, you know, were you first in the class? What, you mean you only came second in the class? Well, that's terrible. You know, now, if you say that to a child, you're really damaging the likelihood is you're really damaging their pleasure in exploration, in adventure, in trying out new ideas, in playing with things, because they've learned that they've always got to be on the top of the pile and they've always got to be successful. Of course, success is great. And of course we want youngsters to have as much success as possible. But we also want to help them to learn when things aren't going successfully, when they're stuck, to enjoy the challenge of learning.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to get that balance right.
And do you think, is that the case in secondary and primary school, or do you need to embed that properly in primary school for it to really sink in with children?
I think you do. You need to get it, well, at primary school and at home. I mean, parents know this, I'm sure, but there's a great article, which I would recommend to some of your listeners if they haven't come across it. You can download it off the internet, which is about Carol Dweck's work, and it's called How Not to Talk to Your Kids. And if you just Google that, you can get this article. It was published in an American magazine a few years ago now. And it just summarizes the research that should make you careful, even with very little children, that can sort of lock them into this idea that they've got to be a good little girl or a bright little boy. So it can start very early. And I think in primary school, as you say, we should really do everything we can to build what I call students' learning power. To give them that ability, that stickability, that willingness to ask questions, to explore, to use their imaginations, to be good at collaborating with other people, to take criticism, because criticism and feedback is what helps you get better.
Yes.
But not to take it personally.
Yes.
That's the important thing. And if we built that platform, that solid identity, as someone who can go out and explore and climb and experiment and play, then learning goes much faster. Learning whatever you have to learn becomes much more pleasurable and much more effective, much more successful. So when children then go on into secondary school, providing, and sometimes this is a big proviso, providing their teachers are willing to welcome children's independence and self-reliance as learners, then they can learn what they have to learn much more easily and smoothly and effectively. But if they don't, that proviso is important, because sometimes in secondary schools, teachers have got can get very locked into their own subject and to their grades and to a sense of sort of panic that we've got to get through the stuff. The curriculum is so crammed with content that there's not much spaciousness. And that's largely true, and it's also partly an attitude on behalf of the teachers.
Mm.
And if the teachers can go looking, despite the pressures, which are real, if teachers could go looking for the time, even just a few minutes in a lesson, for students to be more exploratory, to ask their own questions, to evaluate their own work, to learn how to collaborate better together, then that in itself sort of turbocharges the learning process And not only are you preparing youngsters better for life, but they will also, the research shows this very clearly, they will also do better on the tests.
Oh, okay.
It's not an either-or. We have to get over this stupid idea that we have to choose between traditional and progressive. Actually, we can have both. We can have the building of character and the best results you've ever had in school. But only if you get over that idea that somehow or other these two goals are in competition with each other. That if we start thinking and talking in the way that I've been doing, there are some sort of fuddy-duddies who think, oh, well, that must mean then that Claxton no longer cares about algebra and Shakespeare. That somehow you've taken your eye off the ball of important, difficult content. Not at all.
Right, we're hearing that really clearly. I like that phrase, either, not either or. Have both. Guy, we could talk to you all night. We don't have time, but there is one more question I'd just really love to ask you before you go, please.
Sure.
And that is, one of the statements I read in some of your work was that powerful learners don't need much encouragement because they're already learning because they want to. I mean, for me, that was really eye-opening. I'm a teacher.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, because I wonder why some children don't really respond to praise, and I wonder if it is actually because they're a powerful learner already. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, sure. I mean, one of the other dangers with this praising or overpraising, children are pretty smart on the whole. They know how much effort they put in. They know whether they work damn hard at a piece of work or not. So if they get praised too often or too easily, they lose respect for the praise and sometimes even for the praiser.
Yeah.
So, you know, they can become a bit more disdainful. I mean, look at all the learning, whether you think they're learning the right thing or not, the complex, challenging learning that kids spend hours doing on their PlayStations and their Xboxes and their what have you. Children love being challenged. They love trying to get to the next level.
Yes.
They're built learners, and it's our job is to preserve and, as I say, fit the turbocharger to that natural learning ability, where the goal is to get somewhere you want to go, not to get 10 out of 10 and someone to give you a pat on the top of your head and say, there's a good little girl. We're built like that. So we have to be careful that we don't sully that, we don't interfere with that brilliant biological learning engine that all children come. It's like their operating system. They come bundled with, you know, learning 7.1. Right, when they're born, and we just have to make sure that we keep expanding on that rather than, as sometimes happens, contracting it.
Yeah. And Guy, before we let you go, can you tell us when your book will be out? Does it have a name yet?
We're arguing with the publishers at the moment about the name. The sort of default name at the moment is something like What Our Children Really Need to Learn. And then there's a subtitle. So we want to get that argument going, and we want to involve parents. I've written with my friends and colleagues. I'm writing this book jointly with my friend Bill Lucas, who I've written with a lot before. We've written a lot for teachers, but we really think it's time that we engage parents from the parents' point of view and draw them into the conversation, not least because if parents in their thousands and tens of thousands start arguing and demanding an education that genuinely gives kids a better preparation for life, for university and for life beyond, politicians will start to sit up and take notice. If they think they're going to lose substantial numbers of votes by not supporting these kinds of policies, then that's the most powerful motivator for politicians. So I want to mobilize a groundswell. I want to mobilize an army of mums and dads and uncles and aunties and grandparents who will put pressure on their schools, but also on their politicians, to say that the 19th century system which we're tinkering with needs rapidly to be converted into a 21st century system, and we can help it happen.
Well, Guy, you know, you've got two people in your army here already.
Absolutely. We're converted. Yeah. We're 100% behind you, Guy.
Thank you.
And when will the book be out?
We're hoping in May.
Fantastic. We'll be buying it.
Excellent. Lovely. That's good news. That's two contributions to my pension fund already.
Thank you so much, Guy. It's been really interesting.
My pleasure. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank All you. Good night.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye now.
Welcome back to the Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM, and a huge thanks to Professor Guy Claxton from the University of Winchester for an incredibly interesting interview. I think there's a little bit for everybody there and a lot to take home and think about. Now, to help us process what he was saying, we've got two great local teachers, more than teachers, heads. We've got Morag McCrory, who's deputy head teacher at Beaumont School, and we've got Amanda Godfrey, who's the executive head of Spiral Academies Trust. Welcome to the Parents Show.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Morag. So, some of the things that Guy was saying, you know, it's encouraging parents to get up and be proactive in talking to schools about learning. What do you feel about that?
I mean, I think parents are really critical in terms of supporting their children's learning in school. I think we're all very clear about that. This isn't something that schools can do on their own. We need that input from parents. But I thought also what was really interesting was what he was saying at the end about parents getting involved with perhaps changing the system, because we are in a bind in schools. We certainly want to promote all those qualities that he was talking about, resilience and that wider, you know, building the whole person, absolutely. But we know our parents and our students want also to pass their exams. They need to do that. And how do we get that balance right? And we know that we have got the most tested children in Europe.
Is that true?
That is true. I think there's a lot of evidence to support that. And if you look at countries like Finland, where you know, which are held up as examples of brilliant education systems, they have very little testing and very little central control. And so they're the exact opposite from us. So I think that's where the debate needs to start. And I know that's something that teachers often worry about, just how much our children are tested. And I'd be interested to see if Amanda, I'm sure, would agree with that in primary schools. But that isn't something that schools have got the power to change on their own. And I think that really is where parents would have a big role to play in terms of trying to lobby or pressure for change in that area.
That's the thing that astounded me. I mean, it seems like such a massive change he's asking for. I mean, it's great that he's asking parents, but I'm sure in the back of every parent's mind, they're thinking, I don't want to annoy my son's school or my daughter's school. You know, they've got enough on their plate. Do they need this as well? Amanda, maybe your thoughts on this.
I think what he said that was important is that it doesn't have to be a choice, and he talked about it as that you could do both agendas at the same time, and I think that's really, really important. And what I wouldn't want is to think that, you know, you have to have one style of education or the other. The skill of the teacher is to blend them all together. So yes, we can do the knowledge and the skills, but we can also be developing the culture for learning and the attitude of children at the same time.
And what do you think about the was one thing that kind of resonated with me. He was saying there's two important things. There's you can still get the building of character and the best results. Do you agree, Amanda?
Absolutely. I think that's true. You want a child who's got that tenacity and resilience to carry on learning. And he was talking about that, you know, what do children do when they don't know what to do? And that's exactly what it is. And that's what we want, children who are able to apply their learning and to use it in problem-solving situations. So I don't see it as a tension of a choice between two agendas. I see it as a blending of two. But that's a very skillful thing for teachers to be able to do.
Absolutely. And it's a skillful thing for parents to kind of, and it's outside our comfort zone in lots of ways. So that's what I'll be really interested to get his book. Morag, he said that secondary schools can get locked in and panic to get through the stuff, and perhaps things get lost by the wayside, like the building of character. How do you feel about that?
I think there is a lot of stuff. That's true. We do worry about the stuff. We're having huge changes in secondary. We're getting new A-levels next year. GCSEs are changing. You know, there is always new stuff for us to deal with. But we do try very hard, I think, to hold on to the ideas that those fundamentals about developing really good learning habits and developing that character is important. It doesn't matter what the stuff is. You need to be a good learner. And the idea, I think, is if you look at it, we are preparing our young people today for a world that is changing incredibly rapidly. We have no idea what the world will be like in 20 years when we think how much it's changed in the last 20 years. And so what is important that they go out into the world able to deal with new challenges and they're able to learn new things, because they are going to have to do that for a very long time, and we need to start in schools by developing those habits, I think.
And what do you think about his concept of turbocharging learning? What did you think about that?
In sense of,
Is it something achievable in school with so many pressures?
I think it is when you plan it into the curriculum, and I think it is something also. It needs to be something that everybody does all the time, so it does need to be part of your whole school. You know, ethos in the way you work. And I find it really interesting because we've actually had a big focus at my school this term around be persistent, and everyone was given a little challenge, and then the students were encouraged to vote for someone that they felt had been persistent. So we'd made a big fuss about that, kind of find someone that you think has stuck at somebody, something that's been difficult, and trying to really sort of celebrate that. But again, he's quite right. It takes a long time. You build this up slowly over years, and it's what stops children giving up. And that is the most important thing. Don't give up when the going gets tough, because it's always going to get tough at some point.
Yeah, that's just the way life is.
Absolutely.
And Amanda, he mentioned primary. He mentioned in particular the young girl in primary school and the spiral fitting into the square. How do you feel about him? I mean, obviously that was an exceptional school, but how do you feel about that idea?
I think as schools, we very much want to recognise every child as an individual, and we do see children coming in as so varied and so different, and the skill of the school is to respond to each of those children as individuals. So, you know, I would hope as schools that we've all kind of responded to that challenge and develop ways in schools that we're able to offer slightly different diets for different children according to the needs of them and their families. So, you know, our children are on a journey of preparing them for life, and what we want to do, whether they're 4 or 14, is think, well, what is that this child is the next steps for them? And we try to respond to each of the children. That is, so when children come into school, say the 4-year-old's coming in, some of them are ready to let go of mum's hand and come into school for a full day on the first day straight away. Others are going to need to, you know, hold on to mum's hand and have a slightly slower transition into school. And the school should be able to accommodate those children in their own way, but also moving them in the direction that they need to. Our children start school at age 4, very dependent on their families, and that's the main relationship in their life. And we want them to go on a journey and a continuum that they leave us independent young adults at the end, and they will all go along that journey in a slightly different way, but we do want them all to make the progress.
And do you like his use of the word grit? I have to say, I never think of children and grit, but
I think that's really important. I can, for a long time, I used to have a sticker on my door, but the door got taken down, so I think the sticker went with it. But for a long time, I had a notice on my door that said, "Stuck? Great. Now you're going to learn something." And, you know, children need to know that actually the moment they're really going to learn is when they can't do something.
Yeah.
And the decision they make then and how they continue and persist is absolutely key.
That's really lovely to hear, and you're agreeing more, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that whole thing about children who know what to do when they don't know what to do, that's the key. If you can do that, if the minute you get stuck, you're saying, right, so now I do this, I look in my book, I go and find that out, I research there, this is what I do. Those are the people that are going to do well. And it's not just about rote learning or I know the right answer. It is absolutely about how having those really good habits so you can go off and learn on your own and be independent, and you're not just dependent on the teacher all the time. And it's fundamental. And I absolutely agree as well. It is not either or, it is both and. You know, you need kids who can do that will do well, and they'll also feel confident because they can do it on their own. So they'll, their self-esteem as learners will get boosted because they feel that they're in control of what they're doing, and they're not afraid of being stuck, and they're not afraid of getting it wrong. And that's really important.
He puts a really high emphasis on confidence, doesn't
absolutely.
He?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it's key. I mean, for me, with a son and a daughter, my priority is their self-confidence. Mm. Attainment is second, really. I think it's more important that they feel good about it, that they're happy, and then that they're getting where they want to
be. And that's really, it's really interesting, because we survey our parents. Yeah, we do a big survey fairly regularly, and we say, what do you want for your child? And number one is, I want them to be happy. And number two is, I want them to do well. So they're both at the top of their list, but they're always in that order. I want them to be happy, and then I want them to achieve.
Which is great. Yeah. And that's what parents, that's what teachers want.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's great. What do you, sorry, Amanda, please.
But I think that is also recognising that's not an either-or agenda, because, you know, the children who are happy and confident are very often are going to be the ones who feel that they are being successful as well. That is a key part of it. So I think they have to be blended together.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. What do you think about a 3-day lesson? We're running out of time now. Just quickly before we go, a 3-day lesson, do you think it's possible?
I think it is very possible, and certainly in lots and lots of primary schools, we take very much a theme approach to learning, so you will blend lots of subjects together, and really, really good quality teaching is sort of fairly seamless. I quite like the idea that children don't know whether they're in a history lesson or a geography lesson, because they're kind of, you know, immersed in the content and the engagement of it. So I think that's a fabulous idea, and if that's about problem solving and really investigating things, that's going to make for really fantastic learning.
Brilliant. More like what, 3-day lessons at Beaumont? Do you think it's going to happen?
Well, we do actually suspend our timetable for day-long project days, actually, and we do it once a half term. So we've never done a 3-day one, but certainly a day at a time to work on something over a more extended period. Lots of schools do that. So, you know, again, if that's properly planned into the curriculum, then there's no reason why that can't be done. And students do like it, actually. They like that idea of working on something a bit longer and having something to show for it at the end.
Now, just very last comment. Overall, what are you saying? Do you think Guy Claxton is going to start a revolution? Do you think this is where learning and schools need to go next?
I mean, when you say start a revolution, I mean, a lot of his ideas, I mean, I'm very familiar with his work on building land and power. It's something we've certainly worked with at Beaumont in terms of looking at how we do things. It's been around a while, and it's actually one of the most established programmes, I think, that schools would look at in terms of how to develop good learners. So I think it's an evolution, not a revolution. But I think the reason it is an evolution is because a lot of schools are already trying to work in this way, because a lot of it makes an awful lot of sense to us in terms of what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. It's fantastic to hear you say that. Amanda, I'd love to hear your thoughts too.
Well, we put a huge amount of emphasis on building a positive culture for learning in the school. And to be honest, every school I know does exactly the same. So I completely agree. I don't think it's a revolution, but I really hope we continue that fantastic work.
Thank you so much. That's great. So a fantastic show this evening. And of course, there will be a podcast available on the Parents Show iTunes page in the very near future. So watch out for that. Morg McCrory and Amanda Godfrey, thank you very much for joining us on the Parents Show.
Thank you.
Neve Solicitors are proud to sponsor the Parents Show. The friendly team at Neve's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.